Hey, everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and welcome to the Chicago Jazz Audio Experience Podcast. I am very excited to have the saxophonist James Carter on today, and we're talking about his brand new recording on Blue Note Records, his Blue Note debut, if you will. It just came out August 30th, and it is called James Carter Organ Trio Live from Newport Jazz. And I'm curious about this recording because, James, thanks for jumping on the phone for a few minutes and being on the podcast with
me. Thanks for having me here, and it's such a pleasure to be on the podcast and saturated by all the cyberites out there.
That's right. But how... Okay, so I reading through your bio, and I've listened to your music in the past and all that stuff, and I know there's been a little bit of an overlap. There's been a gypsy jazz thing in your playing, or at least Chasing the Gypsy, which was on Atlantic back in 2000, and things like that. But I guess my first question is, you play saxophone, so why Django Reinhardt and why gypsy jazz?
Well, I've always considered myself a frustrated guitarist that was assigned to a conical-shaped instrument and all. So that's how that designation happened. I give credit to, sonically, to National Public Radio for introducing me to Reinhardt and to Don Byas. We have a National Public Radio affiliate here by under the name WDET. And back in the early 80s, the programming was totally jazz here. I mean, it covered all aspects of jazz. It covered, not only jazz, I mean, avant-garde swing, vintage jazz, Jazz Is Here Now, Hotel Havana. I mean, it covered Afro-Cuban jazz, Rudy Kucich's 52nd Street. But the program that was the catalyst for me and gypsy jazz was Jazz Yesterday, which was hosted by my friend Jim Gallard. And back in 1983, he had this was in the spring, he had a broadcast. I was all of 14 then. And I used to tape over my parents' cassettes and all, like Moody Blues and whatever else, just didn't look, like it was worthy of being on the spool at that time. And in one of these instances, I let the tape flow, and I found out later that I got the Hot Club of France's rendition of Fats Waller's Ain't Misbehaving on there. So I didn't go back and listen to it until months later. And out of all of the things that I had taped on that from that particular broadcast, this one stood out as being just totally different. I mean, three guitars, string bass, violin, and I was like, man, I dig the sound and stuff, and not thinking anything of a project or whatever for myself, but just the sheer, relaxation but urgency was all there encapsulated in this group. So I was like, dig that. So, but didn't know who they were. Because a whole lot of times Jim would, get on and talk, and that would eat into my time of actually having music on here. So there would be times I'd press pause when he'd start talking. Okay, here you go again, So as a result of that, I omitted finding out the name of the group and what the personnel was. So fast forward 15 years later in 1998, I'm on tour in the Netherlands, and we made this truck stop where they had this group of CDs that were just, thrown together by independent, little companies as with these compilations on them. And I see this one that just sticks out that says Swinging with Django on it. So I went ahead and bought it for like five guilder, and I was like, wow, this kind of sounds like that that group I heard some time ago. And so it turns out it was them upon getting some later CDs and stuff from them. And that's how the rekindling of the Reinhardt and the Hot Club thing got started. But what really birthed Chasing the Gypsy was I was actually on tour with Kathleen Battle in 1999, February, March 1999. And we were in Tampa. And she was about 2.5 hours late to her own sound check. And so we were all, it was Cyrus Chestnut, Christian McBride, myself, Romero Lubombo, and Cyril Baptista were in the group.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all set up, and we were just, you know, milling around, nothing to do, waiting on her to come, minute by minute, you know, goes by. So out of nowhere, I start playing New Wires, you know, just on tenor and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And immediately to my left is Romero, and he's like, oh, I know that. And he starts playing the appropriate chords and stuff along with that. So we get this thing going, and also, not to be outdone, Cyril comes in with the shakeray and all this, you know. And so the three of us are playing, and of course, right when our cohesion's at its finest, in walks Kathleen. So Cyrus bangs on the piano and brings us to order, and I just looked at them and at Cyril Romero, and I finger banged them and said, we got to do something with this. So the following day, that morning, I started writing the outline for the Siege to Chasing the Gypsy.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's pretty much how the Hot Club got started, you know, where Jungle, or, you know, Stefan broke a string, went back there and repaired it, and, you know, and started jamming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's
so this is the same way it happened with us.
That music, I mean, the gypsy jazz music, it has such an infectious groove to it when it's done right, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And now that you're describing it this way, and then after listening to some tracks of the you know, the live recording at Newport, and you're adding in the B3 organ, you know, it makes a ton of sense to me, because it's such, you know, that music, I think, shocks a lot of people if they don't know. They're like, oh, I don't know what gypsy jazz is, whatever, they sit down. And all of a sudden, it like really starts grooving. And there's so many little components to it, and so many,
oh, yeah,
you know, how it fits together. It's almost I was talking to somebody earlier about, you know, the Latin music, and everything has layers. And it's the same kind of thing to create that groove.
Yeah.
And taking it now into the trio, the organ trio format of it, how that has to be pretty cool, right? I mean, you start playing some of these tunes with an organ trio, it's probably like, whoa, these things really groove really well.
Yeah. So what happened was, I'd say about, we were still touring the Chasing the Gypsy group, and we were just, I think we were in like Nîmes, France when this happened, but we were at soundcheck. And I just had this idea of, you know, thinking about like what is hip, mm-hmm, from Tower of Power, and superimposing that groove over New Wires. You know?
Yeah.
And from there, that the seeds basically was born of what Unchained would eventually be about, which is lifting that that music and putting it and giving it an urban context.
Mm-hmm.
That people could latch on to, because a whole lot of people, you know, they hear this music in its unplugged acoustic sense, and oh, it's nice and charming. Some people, you know, just, they might go to sleep on it because there's nothing that's driving them electrically, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the purest sense of it. Of course, Jungle would later adapt the electric guitar. And I think most of that was the result of him coming over here in 1946 with Duke Ellington, and figuring that he would, you know, have folks building and, you know, laying guitars and stuff at his feet and all that. And he, mm-hmm, found out it was I felt kind of bad for him when I really started finding out what happened, you know, between the gypsy lifestyle, not having a concept of time. You know, where you gotta go on first curtains at 8 o'clock, and you know, meanwhile you across the town, you know, wowing it away with Marcel Sedan, and you know, just you're supposed to be playing. But anywho, didn't have his own guitar with him, so he had to get used to something else. And but he made it, you know, work and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't stay over long. You know, it's kind of like a dream deferred in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But So what happened as a result of this juxtaposition of what is hip and new age? Just put in my head, what else could we do, you know, in terms of finding another material like this, and how else could we give it that that hood pass, so to speak?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you've some of these tunes, I mean, it's so grooving, it's so swinging, some of them, you know. I mean, there's a couple in there. I mean, how hard was it? Because, I mean, you're talking about a very small amount of music to pick from what Django Reinhardt either wrote or might have been associated with. I mean, how did you come up with putting these specific tracks on this recording?
Well, I'd say the nuts and bolts about Reinhardt and Chain basically started around 2013. And pretty much Gerard and I were spearheading, you know, what if we did this? How about this? We were just brainstorming, and eventually we came up with our core repertoire. And the thing about our core repertoire is that even though we have one song, we have at least two ways of playing it.
Oh, okay.
There's at least two ways of playing each of these tunes other than their original.
Hmm.
Like, for example, Melody of Crepuscule on there, we play it with this sort of Bill Withers thing. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So our second way of playing it is with a Cuban bolero.
Oh, well, that's different.
And when we play a Cuban bolero, I also change instruments as well. Instead of playing soprano, it's on tenor.
Hmm. Okay.
You know.
Well, it almost sounds like
there's also another tune on there that we do that actually came from the first from Chasing the Gypsy, which we didn't do during this hit La Dernière Bergère,
mm-hmm.
which is the lullaby. We do that reggae now.
I love it.
So I mean, it's totally taken the tunes out of its normal fetters and letting them, you know, fly, you know, in that sense.
Well, and it's probably pretty easy when there's just three of you, right? So, I mean, you can probably go up on stage and say, hey, man, let's try this thing with this groove tonight or that groove or whatever, and everybody can kind of lock and say, yeah, all right, let's try it that way. Because it's a different vibe than if you had like five or six or ten guys up on stage where you got to worry about a lot of other things. The trio format, I think, gives somebody a lot more freedom to do that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, and it's very elastic in that sense, but I think, you know, regardless to how many members it is, as long as you all have the cohesion and keep your wits about yourself and be in service to the collective at that particular time, everything's going to fall in line.
So let's talk a little bit. So James Carter, Organ Trio, live from Newport Jazz. This is your debut on Blue Note Records. I can't believe you haven't been on Blue Note Records. You've been on so many other labels, and you've recorded with so many people. You've toured all over the place. What was your initial reaction to all of a sudden being approached by Blue Note Records for this?
It was a dig that moment. I mean, it pissed me to say the least. When you grow up, you know, with I don't know how many Blue Note catalogs, you know, albums and CDs and whatnot, tapes in your collection over the years, and all of a sudden be a part of that machine that eventually you'll be the soundtrack to somebody else's, you know, lifetime, you know, through Blue Note. It's a dream and a half, you know.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. Well, and coming up, so you grew up in Detroit, and, you know, we're that scene in Detroit, I mean, that's still a strong scene over in Detroit. I mean, there's a lot of guys that come over to Chicago and play in Chicago and go back and forth. I mean, I know a lot of people from Chicago goes over and they play in Detroit. I mean, who are some of your...
I think the Midwest in general is a strong, has a strong sense anyway. I mean, there's a nice little alley. I guess you can call it Tornado Alley, if you will. But Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, Columbus, Dayton, St. Louis, Kansas City. You know, there's
Indianapolis.
near Indianapolis. But you get the idea that there's this pocket right there in the middle of this continent that just has convergences of grooves and, you know, peoples and lifestyles, and it amalgamates and externalizes itself in the music.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many similarities, like when I did Robert Altman's Kansas City back in 1995,
mm-hmm.
to be there in Kansas City for the very first time and to experience that some of the street names are the same and some of the people are the same. It's just a matter of what color alligator shoes they're wearing, and, you know. And also, we have a musical, you know, legacy here that we're definitely proud of that has an institution, and so do they there,
mm-hmm.
you know. And to be able to keep out those similarities and say that this is a parallel universe and the peoples that, you know, just dig you just from that, that says a heck of a lot, man.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, growing up in Detroit, I mean, you and I are around the same age. So, I mean, you know, growing up in Detroit, I mean, there was some, that scene, you know, 90s, you know, late 80s, 90s. I mean, there was a lot of music happening, I think, in Detroit. I mean, it was just like in Chicago. I mean, who were some of your inspirations, some of your influences that did you used to go hang out at clubs and just like soak up the music?
I mean, the 80s. Once again, just like with National Public Radio, it was such a fertile time.
Mm-hmm.
I just mentioned a few programs on National Public Radio. We also still had WJZZ here that was still coming correct as well. But public radio really had more of a down-home sort of thing where it informed you as opposed to, you know, even though JZZ was commercial, it still kind of had a grassroots community sort of vibe to it, too. Like when you'd hear the Sundown Jazz Calendar of who's playing, held over at Baker's, held over, you know, such and such coming to the music hall and blah, 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 you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The scene was also the same way as well, too. I mean, Bert's. He wasn't the marketplace at the time. He was Bert's place, and he was over on Jefferson and Shelby, where the it's now People Mover stop. But he had a three-floor building there.
Mm.
And he had blues on one floor, jazz on the other, and disco on the third. And, you know, and it was all going down, mm-hmm. you know. There were also some smaller places that didn't stick around too long. There was Cafe Joseph, which was down over there by, I think, Grand River and Clifford, something like that. Shirley's Half Note, which became the board. Is it the boardroom? Yeah, later became the boardroom. Dummy George's over there on 6 Mile and Griggs. There was Al Mitchell's Blue Sky, which was out in Southfield.
Mm.
And I mentioned that club in particular because he didn't have liquor in his place, so he could stay open all night.
He didn't have liquor, but he had live music?
He had live music.
Wow.
And he had a Creole Cajun cuisine there. Instead of, in lieu of liquor, he had Sir St. Julian's sparkling cider and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
First set was at 11 p.m.
Oh, man.
That's how it, you know, and it would last till like 6 in the morning. And that's when the festival was, you know, happening. Ooh,
oh, yeah.
You wouldn't get back home in the sun up or whatever, you know. And then that was the other thing about when it was the Montreux Detroit Festival. It was a week-long festival.
Wow.
Back then. You know, not this 3 and 4 day stuff that they basically eking out now.
Mm-hmm.
But it was 3 and 4 days, and there was all the international or national artists had to mandatorily do some sort of meet and greet, master class, lecture or something. They just didn't come in there and promote their album and Scooby-Wah and get their change and split.
Mm-hmm.
They had to put in some work, Every time.
Well,
every blinking time.
And that, I mean, that right there, I mean, that you bring up a great point, because I know the Detroit Jazz Fest was just last week, and so was the Chicago Jazz Fest and stuff. And nowadays, I mean, I sponsor the fest here and all that stuff. And you know, you pop in, you play a set, you never see any of the artists hanging out or anything, and then they split.
Mm-hmm.
And giving back,
oh, they had to hang in.
Yeah, see, I mean, and that's so important too, because somebody like you coming up, I mean, you got to meet all these guys probably because they had to meet you, but
yeah,
but there was that connection there.
And we were running around all. Oh, and Donald Walton's Loft.
Okay,
I can't be remiss without mentioning that place, because this was totally grassroots, where we would have our rehearsals for like stuff that was upcoming at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And of course, that was a venue in and of itself as well. It was also the first place that I saw the Coltrane Legacy on VHS. So it was like the first time I ever saw Coltrane move, and you know. And,
oh, wow.
Oh, man. Huh. So in between sets, they were actually showing these videos. You know, we were just looking at them like we were seeing, you know, fire for the first time. Mm-hmm. It's like Coltrane's moving, and it's actually, and Elvin and Dolphy, and, you know, wow, you know. And then it'd be time to go back on again. And, but no, it was a very fertile time here. It was a very hip time to come up as a musician, particularly in this genre. We also had Jimmy Wilkins's big band, which basically at that time I was, you know, starting off as a freshman at Northwestern, and in that jazz band, we had most of Count Basie's music.
Oh, wow.
Oh. Because of Jimmy Wilkins, of course, along with his brother Ernie, were single-handedly responsible for the New Testament Basie band that came after the, you know, after the 50s.
Sure.
Because Ernie, his brother Ernie, was writing the charts and the arrangements and whatnot, Shiny Stockings, you know, things of that ilk. Frank Foster, you know, was also in that mix as well. So we were privy to all of these charts because of our band director's affiliation. He played lead alto in Jimmy Wilkins's big band. And as a result, he would get the charts from Jimmy, and we were playing them in high school. And that served a twofold effect. I mean, it was also passing the that Basie repertoire along with us so it wouldn't die, you know, just within the members of the Basie band. And it also allowed for Jimmy to pick from a wellspring of individuals, young cats that were coming up in the ranks that were playing this music. Like whenever some of the older guard would get sick or couldn't make a gig or whatever, they would pluck one of us out of the band and say, all right, we're going to play such and such, you know.
Oh, man, what an experience.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So that's how it went down.
Well, you know, it's unbelievable, because I mean, we could talk like for hours about everything you've done and all the experiences you've had. You know, and maybe when you come to Chicago at some point, I know actually you're coming to Chicago November 10th, the Blue Note Records 80th birthday celebration. That's going to be at the Mackinac Arts Center, which is out in Glen Ellen. At themac.org is where you guys can get tickets. And because you're a Blue Note artist now, you get to go on this incredible tour and celebrate the 80th birthday of Blue Note Records. You're going to be there with Candace Springs, and also a few other folks are going to be joining you on those sets. I mean, you're doing that, and then you're also touring with your own group. And, I mean, you're staying very busy. You've got a lot of stuff going on.
I'm eventually, I think towards the end of the year, I'll eventually get back to getting busy.
Yeah.
I just recently took a nice little spaghetti. I guess we're coming towards the end of it. I'm celebrating 23rd wedding anniversary on the 31st.
Oh,
our
wow.
Son's 16th birthday was on September the 1st.
Holy cow.
And our kids just recently went back to school. You know, so well, we're doing pretty good here.
Yeah. Well, just looking
chilling.
Over.
I didn't attend any part of the fest because I was have my own festivities.
Well, you're taking a breather. You're taking a breather, but looking over your calendar, you're about to get very busy here in September, October, November, and starting to travel and everything. And of course, coming to Chicago, November 10th at the Mackinac Arts Center. But this new recording, I mean, you know, everybody can pick it up. It's at BlueNote.com, and then also JamesCarterLive.com, and it's called James Carter Organ Trio Live from Newport Jazz. And I'll tell you, just you've got to pick it up if you love grooving B3 organ. I have to ask before we hop off here, I mean, is there is B3 organ always been something that's inspiring to you? Because I love hearing a B3 organ. I mean, I play drums, so when I'm playing with an organ player, it sounds like there's like a train coming down the tracks, and it's very effortless.
Exactly.
And to be able to play solos on top of that has to be unbelievable, right?
Yes. My first encounter B3 wise, or of course, from a patron standpoint or a listener standpoint, was at the Cookhouse.
Okay.
You know, particularly the family cookouts where they would have the music being pumped through. Jay-Z would be playing something like Live at the Chicken Shack with Jimmy Smith, or, you know, something along that line. Larry Young, and, you know, and it just laid the, you know, the soundtrack for eating ribs and potato salad and collard greens and all that other things. You know, and then so it just, you know, gave you the sonic backdrop and all. But personally, from another aspect of it was my cousin's church on the east side, Mount Elliott Church of God in Christ, was the first time that it really stuck to me and went through my system. Like, I could not believe that this, you know, this organ was putting out that much, you know, power and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and coming from Detroit, I mean, with the Motown connection, I mean, with the, I mean, there's B3 organ on a lot of the Motown stuff, and with the jazz stuff, and you know, to me, I love the organ trio with drums, organ, and I love the saxophone, because it just adds another element to it. You know, a lot of times you hear guitar, but sax, it just, it I think it allows you, maybe, you can tell me if I'm wrong, allows you to kind of really kind of let loose. I mean, you've got a lot more space because there's a lot of stuff happening underneath you, so you can just kind of let your mind flow, I would imagine, in your soloing.
Oh, yeah, it's a power trio personified. I mean, it's just a power group.
Yeah.
In general, you know. Got one cat that's holding down all the harmonic information, you know, and grooving with it at the same time, and he can be his own flock of birds, you know, and and let it fly, and it's, you know, you can't beat that with a bat.
No, no. Well, and this,
you
know, recording,
you can't,
man,
beat it from not only that that aspect, but from a personnel standpoint and the financial aspect of, you know, it's just three cats, you know, as opposed to hiring a big band, or not saying anything against hiring a big band, but, you know, the promoter isn't going to say no.
The economics of an organ trio are much better than a big band. That's for sure.
Quite.
It's much easier to travel.
Even with extra accoutrements on it, too, yes.
That's right. It's much easier to travel with an organ trio than a big band. But, congratulations on this recording. James Carter, Organ Trio, live from Newport Jazz. It's available at BlueNote.com. Of course, all the information on where James is going to be playing, if he's coming to a town near you, since this podcast is not just heard here in Chicago, JamesCarterLive.com. And, James, hopefully you'll be coming through Chicago with the organ trio. I know you're going to be out at the Mac on November 10th, but maybe we'll get
you
the jazz showcase or something, you know?
I'd love to get back there and be taken off of the milk carton, because the last time I was at the showcase was 2006, I want to say.
That long ago?
That long ago.
Holy cow. All right, well, we got to take care of that. I know everybody. I know Wayne and Joe over at the showcase. Well, I'll tell them to call you, because at that organ trio and for 4 days at the showcase, that would be blazing, and that would be a lot of fun.
Especially right about now, we'd make sure.
Oh yeah. You know, 100%. Well, I'm gonna
get my folks there as well too. Eight Bold Souls, Ed Wilkerson, Mwata Bolden, Naomi Millinder, all them peoples. A collector free gonna be guaranteed to be had.
Well, hey, I thank you so much for jumping on the Chicago Jazz Audio Experience podcast today, and congratulations on the new recording.
Thanks for having me, and
congratulations.
Thanks for the support.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, everybody can listen to more episodes on everywhere that podcasts are available. Also, ChicagoJazz.com, ChicagoJazzMagazine.com. We've got videos and everything. So until next time, hopefully we will see you all somewhere out on the scene.